Welcome to all the fans of the true counterculture, alt-rights, new rights, nationalists, and identitarians who are as concerned as we are about our people, our countries, our values, culture, and, of course, our future. This is Red Ice Radio, one-of-a-kind, independent, alternative radio with headquarters in Sweden, Northern Europe, and also on the North American continent. My name is Henrik, and it is, as always, good to have you with us. I'm going to continue to plug the upcoming Red Ice TV Marathon broadcast at the start of the radio show so that we can alert any newcomers about it, and also for those of you who might not listen to every single show. So, Red Ice Radio, not the website, but the radio program, is turning 10 years old in April. The radio show has really been the flagship of Red Ice, so it is worth celebrating. So we wanted to do more videos and TV broadcasts for some time now, so this is a perfect opportunity to jump on that finally. For the first thing we're going to produce, we're going to do a marathon show, a live show with guests. We'll take callers. We'll talk a bit about the last decade that has been, our intentions, our move through many of the topics that we've covered, and where we are today and how we got here, to someone who just looks through our archives for the first time as they go further back. It might just seem like a mishmash, hodgepodge of topics, but there is a reason to the seeming madness. So I'm going to talk a bit more about that. But more importantly, we are, during this first marathon, also going to talk about what we are going to both be able to do and what we want to do with this new live TV show, the latest edition. We'll start probably a few weeks after or so the first marathon live show and do a weekly wrap-up on Saturdays on a weekly basis. We are going to begin nice and easy and build it up as we go forward, but this is going to turn into a TV channel eventually, and we are going to have on the long term several different shows on the channel, but the initial plan is to have many different segments within our weekly show. I'll explain all of this during the first show that we'll do. So the first live show is also going to be a fundraiser, the first that we've ever done, by the way. We have always asked those who want to support us to sign up for a membership with us so that you'll get something for your support as well. Now, this is a bit different because we want to get you involved and you could be part of helping us to build this new TV show or channel. We've invested quite a bit already to get this up and running and get it to the way we want tech-wise, but it's far from perfect or the best that it can look. But it will do an okay job for now. We really need to improve the quality of the cameras, for example, but you'll be able to see what is possible and get a good idea of what this could turn into and see if this is something you want to be part of and help out. I have tons of ideas that I want to share with you during the broadcast, and we want you to call in and share your ideas with us. You'll be able to watch it through redicemembers.com and redicecreations.com. We're also going to look for correspondents and reporters. I'll explain this during the show, but anyone who wants to be part of the show so that we can get our people, our perspective, our views out on the streets, into the field, and utilize the great network that we already have out there and cover some of the stories and events as they unfold from our perspective instead of relying on the mainstream media and the cucks setting up their own faux opposition to it. So we're looking at the end of this month, Saturday, April 30th. This is actually Valpurgis night, and it's a good time to do it. We've not yet decided the time of day. We'll probably start evening, Central European time, afternoon, late afternoon, Eastern U.S. time. We'll have the exact times and time zones on the website here as we create the pages for it soon. But this first marathon fundraiser will be laid back. It'll be fun, not too structured. We'll go with the flow. Lana and I will be hosting the show, and we have other people joining in throughout the evening as well. So we'll keep you posted. I'll keep mentioning the details at the start of the radio shows as we move closer to it so that we'll keep you up to date. So mark your calendars, Saturday, April 30th, Valpurgis night. It's the Red Ice 10-year anniversary live TV show, a marathon and a fundraiser. It'll be a lot of fun. You definitely want to be part of it. It's going to be the beginning of something really good and important. All right, but back to the current day here now. We have a show to introduce to you as well. We have invited four gentlemen from Down Under, Tough Love from New Zealand, and from Australia, Gustav, Ositori, and Mammon. We are going to give you an overview and a rundown of many of the concerns that we discuss on this show, but from an Australian and New Zealand perspective. We have a lot of listeners in both of these countries, and just as in Europe and America, we are being hit hard with the propaganda to give up on the countries that our ancestors toiled, struggled, spilt blood, and died in order to build. Our countries is now something that every other race, every other people has more or less free access to, wide open borders. And this goes on as our hostile elites are doing this to us. and exploiting our open and trusting and hospitable nature. We are being told that we are not doing enough, that we are the problem, that too many of us congregating in one area is not only problematic, it's volatile, racist, and will lead to KKK groups forming and gas chambers being built. There's no end to the absurdity. We're going to let our guests do the introduction and have them say a few words about themselves as we begin. Stay tuned. Welcome, gentlemen. Thank you so much for being here. It is an ungodly hour here, and I know it's late where you guys are down under as well, so thank you to all of you for coming on and bearing with us with the time differences. I think I said before the recording, this would have been a lot easier if the Earth was flat and we were just in one time zone here together. But let's just say welcome to one at a time here so our audience can hear who's who. We have Tough Love from New Zealand. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Henrik. Pleasure.
Very good. We have Gustav. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Henrik. It's good to be on.
Very good. We have Maman with us as well. Glad to have you here.
Great to be here. Thanks.
And finally, Ozzy Tory. Great to have you here, Ozzy.
Very appreciative you for having me on.
Very good. Now, we haven't really dedicated an entire program to talk about Australia and New Zealand yet. It's definitely been coming up, though. I mean, we, in relation to multiculturalism, immigration, and kind of the same level displacements that is happening in Europe and North America, we haven't really touched on it specifically, so this will be really good to get some of this out to our audience and inform our audience about what is going on down there. But do you guys maybe want to just say a few words about yourself before we start talking about the main subjects of Australia and New Zealand? Tough Love, maybe we can begin with you. Do you just want to say a few words about yourself?
Yeah, sure. I am a New Zealander of European descent, so British and Irish. And I grew up here in New Zealand, and I've been writing a blog for a wee while now called Tough Love Letters, which is sort of focusing on white identity and growing up in a multicultural country. I say that with a dose of kind of irony and strangeness.
All right, very good. We'll definitely talk more about that. Gustav, you want to give us a few words?
Yeah, sure. Well, I was really into libertarianism when I was at university, and I've kind of had an interest in conservative politics, and then discovered the alternative right and realized, you know, what's happening like around the world and in our country, and followed a lot of NPI and Greg Johnson and found TRS. And so since then, me and Mammon and Ozzy Tory have formed a group called the Dingoes or in TRS, a number of other Australians who can see what's happening and want to do something about it, and not just kind of passively observe the Europeans and the Americans being involved in things. So we've been recording a podcast, The Convict Report, for about 16, we're on our 16th episode now.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we're excited about what we can do in the future.
Very good. Yeah, we'll definitely talk a bit more about that and give out the website and whatnot for that. Maman, how about you?
So young guy from Australia, and just grew up in a very progressive household environment, and university I experienced the intense anti-Western rhetoric from my peers, and tried to understand that, and got caught up in the libertarian zeitgeist or the online movement, and then kind of fell off and went down the rabbit hole of neo-reactionary blogs. And eventually found TRS, and just like Gustav said, kind of became aware of what's happening to our people and tried to find an outlet to advocate for our people, and wound up making this podcast.
Very good. Ozzy Tory, same path for you?
Slightly different. I discovered nationalism, goodness me, I must have been around 14, 15, through, of all things, folk metal. Joined a forum, they got me into thinking a bit more about my identity and where I fit into this world. Then I discovered a few other racialist fora, which I won't name names. They're a bit disreputable these days for how far the movement has moved along. Got active probably my first year of uni. So I've been active in various conservative, traditionalist, nationalist groups for close to a decade now. Stumbled upon TRS a few years ago, became an avid listener with The Daily Shower, joined the forum that came up, met these fine gentlemen, and we decided to start our own podcast, The Convict Report, and now our own website, thedingoes.xyz. And the rest is history, as they say.
All right, very good. Now, well, let's begin with Australia. I mean, I've heard from, as I said, from a few listeners about what is going on with immigration, the rise of Islam, I would say Asian colonization. But what really surprised me was when I saw some of the violent demonstrations that that Muslims were doing, etc. Really caught me off guard, to be honest. But guys, let's just we'll talk about New Zealand after this too. But let's talk a bit generally about what is going on in Australia, and maybe you guys can give our audience an idea of what is happening there right now, and how you would explain this to someone who's an outsider. Who would like to pick up on that?
So Australia faces similar challenges to the United States and Britain and Europe in terms of having a Muslim minority that is supported by the mainstream media and by the government in agitating a kind of victim complex and railing against mainstream Australian culture as a racist, sexist, intolerant, hateful and bigoted, ugly culture that's really beneath theirs, which is, you know, rich and vibrant and so on. And so whipped up by media commentators and even our own kind of government, our government media outlet, the ABC, we've had a series of violent, Islamic demonstrations. In 2012, when someone insulted the Prophet, there were violent demonstrations in the city. There were the Cronulla riots, which were mostly whites having a gathering in response to a series of attacks by Muslims in white areas of young women at the beach, which was spun by the media as a kind of white racism, when there was a lot of background to that, and that's kind of been a big talking point since then, that Australia is a racist society. So I think if you're in Europe or in the US, you can relate very much to the Australian circumstance, because we had a homogeneous white society right up until the 1970s, when our policy was changed by a similar process of leftist Trotskyist elites infiltrating our government and our bureaucracy and pushing for multiculturalism, especially from a particular ethnic group.
Right. I mean, I think in Australia, the Fabian Society have been fairly big. It's been a powerful branch of the British, you know, Big Brother system over there. And in many regards, it seems that it's kind of, in terms of identity or whatever you want to call that, it seems like Australia is struggling in many regards with the same issues that America is, that due to the fact that it's not, you know, the European heartland, we had Europeans moving into this area. It's, you know, the nation is, you know, a few hundred years old, a little bit more. And this is causing the whole situation to basically be turned against Australia, and as it is in America, right, that you guys are the invaders. And is it difficult for you guys to kind of like assert your identity as being tied to Australia? Is that how the government is using it against you guys in the same way they do in America?
Yes. They say that we're all immigrants and that we're all equal and that we all came here by boat and that there's no difference between an Australian farmer whose grandparents or whose forefathers came here in the 1800s and is a seventh generation farmer, and then a Chinese man who's arrived 2 months ago, that we're all just as Australian as each other. So there's a fundamental denial of Australianness, and that there was an authentic Australian culture that was European and British before the change of our immigration policies.
Yeah, exactly. Anyone else want to jump in on that?
Sure. I think Gustav has nailed it quite correctly there, that it's an issue of, we need to look at the geopolitical context for what was happening in the 1950s and 60s and 70s within our region. It was a growing time of Asian nationalism, and the British Empire was ceasing to be the power within the region. From, was it 1967, the British had resolved to move east of Suez. So there was no more presence there. And prior to that entire time, from our colonial period up and from the 20th century, that was the big guarantor, the British Navy, of Australia's security in a hostile region. So bringing it back actually to where we are today for your listeners for a comparison, I would say it approaches something more like South Africa, where it was the case of a white, so you've got the Boer Volk, the Dutch speakers, and then the later English and British colonists who had their minority rule over against this larger foreign element. And then post, was that 90s, it became the reverse of that. So they are themselves the hostile minority amongst a minority in a much more hostile environment. That's what Australia became from the 60s onwards. And one way that a lot of our technocrats thought that they could deal with that was to acquiesce to a lot of the claims of these Asian nationalists, where their nationalism was predicated not so much on a love of themselves, but a kind of hatred of colonialism, and Australia came to stand in for that colonialism. So we had various academics. There was a group called the Immigration Reform Committee operating out of Melbourne University in the 1960s. They released a paper in 1962 which said that in order to engage in the region, we need to have Asians in Australia, because only having Asians in Australia can we have the perspective to engage in the region. That's what they said. Then we had our diplomats in the foreign affairs and trade who said that they couldn't do their job whilst having an exclusionary migration policy, even though that flew in the face of the claims of their hosts in the Asian nations they were staying in, because they were having a very exclusionary policy of kicking out any European elements from their society. So there was this real double standard that came into effect. Now, so that's a broader picture of what was happening. And then out of that picture came this vacuum of an identity in Australia. Because like I was trying to articulate just then, this idea of Australia being tied to Britain and Europe, but particularly in the British Isles. That's what Australianism was. It was a organic development out of Europe and Britain in our, on you know, on our shores here, out of that. But then with that geopolitical context, in our elites' eyes, that became untenable. So from 1967 onwards, there was it's actually a so-called conservative government under Harold Holt. He funded the arts a lot more than his successor, John Gorton. And then come the Whitlam prime ministership, which was the Great Watershed, that introduced a lot of the hostile elements against our culture and our people, our way of life, from the 72 to 75 until its dismissal. And these greater funded arts movements, they came up with this thing called the New Nationalism, which was an attempt to divorce this ethnic identity that Australia used to have based on Europeanness and Britishness in particular, and base it on values and other left-wing ideology. But the only thing that survived out of that was multiculturalism.
Right.
So we've had this broad process of intellectuals, government officials and technocrats attacking the Australian nation because they were too afraid to actually stand up for who and what we are as a European people in this foreign region, you know, against this hostile world, because they couldn't do it. They tried to change the game there, completely turn the table on everyone, and that just culminated in the 70s and 80s until we got to the 90s, where what happened was the culture war, which was the Keating government, which was a Labor government. Now, Paul Keating himself was very animated against a white Australia. His two big things were native title, so the recognition of Australian Aborigines at the expense of white European Australians, and advocating for a republic, so severing all institutional ties to Europe and Britain. And he had the two narratives kind of enforce one another, where a lot of conservatives argue that the British monarchy is what, you know, grounds us in this region. It's what makes us kind of who we are, reminds us that we're from Europe, that we're Britons or Europeans in Australia or on the edges of Asia. We're not an Asian country. So he wanted to take that out of the picture and replace it with this view of Aboriginal past being what informed the nation, while coming up with this republic that was to integrate into Asia, which is, you know, coming good on the promise of what these intellectuals wanted in the 60s and 70s. So that's the broader picture on the attack on the Australian people and nation from the 50s right up to the 90s to the present day. So to put it simply, yes, it's very hard to stand up for the Australian nation and people when our top politicians and diplomats and academics have been hostile to us for a number of decades.
Interesting. Yeah, I wonder if the UK, you know, if they kind of took the lead on multiculturalism, and then that Australia, as a part of that Commonwealth, felt obliged to kind of follow along in there, or was there a detachment at some point saying, well, no, we can do our own thing, we're going to go our own path. However, the end result has been obviously the same, more or less.
Well, multiculturalism was actually the way that we use multiculturalism. It first came out of Canada. It was this 1965 meeting of this Slavic association who disagreed with these terms of reference to a royal commission into Canadian bilingualism and biculturalism. So the French Canadians and the British Canadians. So this newly arrived migrant group disliked those terms of reference and wanted to discuss multiculturalism. And that usage filtered through, I guess, the Commonwealth until it became the political wisdom in Australia. The funny thing is to bring in New Zealand at this stage, the Maoris in New Zealand didn't like the use of multiculturalism, and we had a reverse of what we saw in Canada, where the Maoris saw any talk of multiculturalism as being, white New Zealanders reneging on the old treaty that they had with Maoris. the Maoris said, no, New Zealand is bicultural, bilingual. It's European, British, and Maori, nothing else.
Right. Interesting. Well, actually, tough love, we can have you come in at this point and actually talk a bit more if it parallels them to Australia and the background. I guess it's a very similar situation, right?
Very similar, yeah. I had to stop going on Facebook because with this refugee crisis that started really coming in heavy last year, people were doing signal fests on Facebook, and the big thing that a lot of them were saying were that New Zealand has always been a multicultural country. It's built on immigrants coming to look for a better life and a new start. And so how can we say that there's a line in the sand where that history is ended and now no new people are allowed to come? And, you know, it's this massive disconnect between the infrastructure builders and infrastructure takers, I guess.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, up until the 1960s, 70s, New Zealand was 85% white, and was only 85% because, and we can get into this, the country was already occupied by the Maori people when we got here. So the multiculturalism that people are imagining that goes right back to the beginning of the founding of our nation is, it's multicultural Europe. So it's English, it's Irish, and it's Scottish predominantly. You know, you've got the, after World War II, you've got more Europeans coming in from different countries seeking asylum, but the actual multiculturalism that people are really talking about on Facebook, that's from the 1970s onwards, when there was a rewriting of our immigration laws, and we started having big increases in non-European minorities coming in and really fleshing out the population.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, this is occurring also at the same time in most, at least Western European countries, not to drag in Sweden into this, but it's, you know, the same thing happens in you know, 70, 75, something like that, and the same arguments. I mean, even despite the ridiculousness of it, we get slammed with the Sami kind of angle, you know, which is, again, in terms of territory, which is just ridiculous. They're way up in the north, and it was much later that, you know, Sweden expanded into the territory it is today. But, Gustav, I wanted to ask you something. You wrote a few notes about what's called the history wars, the black armband versus white blindfold. I guess that kind of fits right into what we're talking about right here.
It does. There was a new vision of Australian history, which came about around in the 1960s, which tried to assert that the founding of Australia and its colonization was, in fact, a great injustice, and that that it's something to be ashamed of, that white people came here and stole the land from the Aborigines. And it was summed up, or it really started with what was called the Mabo case, which was when there was an Australian Aboriginal man who went to court against the federal government and won, with a lot of help from, again, from a certain ethnic group. And he asserted what was called native title. So a native title allowed a level of Aboriginal land rights that wasn't previously possible. And now Aborigines own roughly 10% of Australian land. And so this narrative that colonization was, rather than a process of taking over what was considered to be called terra nullius, so, you know, vacant land that was uninhabited and wasn't homesteaded, that in fact, there were people living here, and there were people living here, but they hadn't developed the land. And the idea that even though there were bad things that happened during the colonization, there's no doubt about it. The idea that there's this grand narrative arc of goodies and baddies and evil white colonial oppressors and the kind of Rousseauian savages who were the natives is what most ordinary Australians think is what happened. That's what we learn at school. And that's what's called what our Prime Minister John Howard from the 1990s called the black armband view of history, which diminishes the achievements of our forefathers and of the settlement and the founding of Australia. So what we're trying to point out and trying to educate people about is that is a, you know, it's a very emotionally loaded and also historically and factually inaccurate narrative. And It's just everywhere we look. I think our former Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, issued an apology about 5 years ago to the Aborigines. And, you know, a totally vacuous apology saying, oh, yes, you know, we apologize, as, you know, this kind of grandiose gesture, which really was symbolic to the kind of genuflecting or the kneeling in front of the altar of white guilt. And so this narrative of white guilt is kind of pushed on everyone. And the idea that, oh, yeah, Aboriginal culture was just as valid and just as sophisticated and that, you know, we can learn so much from them. The other aspect that's still pushed is, what's called the gap, which is, a function of white guilt that Aboriginal populations in Australia have much worse life and health outcomes than non-Aboriginal Australians. They tend to die 15 to 17 years younger than the rest of the population, which is due to a series of factors, mostly lifestyle choices, diabetes, alcoholism, drug use, overeating, heart disease, smoking, all of these kind of things that are kind of to be expected from certain populations with higher time preference that haven't adapted to 21st century you know, welfare life, right? Which is really quite unsuitable. The other thing that is that Aboriginal people in this narrative of white guilt have in fact gotten much worse in terms of all of their outcomes. So part of the black armband view is that what's called the stolen generations, which was in the earlier part of the 20th century, a lot of Aboriginal children were taken, especially half-caste children, were taken from their families and put in white homes to be trained as domestic servants, or they were put in Christian mission schools where they were taught English and mathematics, and we were tried to be included in mainstream society. And that's now seen as a great injustice, rather than it was considered at the time that these children were being rescued from abusive homes. And so the funny thing is that today this is still happening, because we still have child protection agencies that try and save Aborigines from when there are cases of abuse, but they still try and weave the narrative into it. It's a white guilt that all of these children are taken away because of the conditions that their parents and their communities create for them, yet we're still meant to feel bad about it.
Right. So
it's quite a complicated series of things that are kind of all wielded as a weapon against our sense of our righteousness and our moral legitimacy in this country.
Interesting. Tori, feel free to jump in if you have something to add, by the way.
You know, I think Gustav got that correct, that the apotheosis of his black armband view of history was with the Mabo case. But going into Kevin Rudd's apology, because that was an apology to the stolen generation, but prior to that, we had Paul Keating in 1992 give his speech. It's called the Redfern Park speech, where Redfern is a rather large aboriginally populated suburb in the inner city of Sydney. It's where we've got this building called The Block, which is kind of like a housing commission for them that's run by this Aboriginal council. But at the moment, the council is wanting to demolish it and give it, redevelop it and make a profit on Chinese international students, because it's just a stone throws away from one of the top universities in Australia, Sydney University. But they've said they're going to give like one level to Aboriginal people. Anyway, so that's the area where he gave this speech. And in this speech, it hadn't quite got to the stage of white guilt yet, because we're still talking the early 90s here. Now, these are Australian Four. They're not particularly noted for their forethought and, I guess, intellectual acumen here. So in this speech, he says that we needed to recognise that we dispossessed Aboriginal Australia, that that's something that has to be recognised, where that this kind of idea of, you know, acknowledging, I guess, this hyperbolic atrocity that happened in the settler days goes back yet to all this 60s scholarship. There was this sociologist in 1969 or thereabouts, W.H. Stanner, who gave a lecture on the ABC's Boyer Lecture Series, which is a very prestigious kind of public lecture series that happens on our national broadcaster, and he called it the Great Australian Silence of these quote-unquote unacknowledged relations. And then from this time onwards, social history became very prevalent. So that's, you know, the idea of these marginalized voices in history, whether that's women or minorities. And in our context, that became Aboriginal Australians. So from this is all high-level theoretic abstract stuff. So by the time it filtered into our politicians, that's the 90s or so. But it hadn't yet, it's not quite yet white guilt. It's talking more about our shame at what was going on, but still, it's still this indictment on the historic founding people of Australia. And there was a insipid conservative backlash against that, hence why it's the culture wars, even though it was more like the culture slaughter, because of the right put up barely a fight. And that mostly happened around 1988 with the bicentenary of Australia, where we've got this somewhat conservative journal. It's very neocon. It's characterized by a very aging demographic, where there's a certain demographic, as Gustav is calling them. I think your listeners can put two and two together there.
Oh, yeah.
Who are now circling the carcass of this journal. But anyway, this has been kind of like the pinnacle of right-wing intellectualism in Australia, Quadrant magazine.
Right, yeah.
And they Yeah, I'm sure you've heard of
Sure, Frank Salter has published quite a bit in there, and there's some okay stuff coming through there. Definitely, well, it was a big step for them, of course, when they published Frank Salter. That was going far, I guess, but yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, it's just had this history of being like the right-leaning journal in Australia. So a lot of academics fought back in its pages against all of these decades, you know, at least two decades worth of far-left, really abstract attacks on Australia. But it fell on deaf ears, really. And they couldn't really influence our quote-unquote conservative government, the John Howard years, which I think outside of Robert Gordon Menzies, he's Australia's longest-serving prime minister. So, but that's the funny thing. He rode on the coattails of this backlash against the black armband view of history, Howard. But he did bugger all in office. He's let that narrative take over, so much so that he allowed this Marxist to write the history school curriculum. So that's history is compulsory in grades 9 and 10. He wrote, you know, what our students have to read. And this is under the nose of conservative government, who made great overtures for rolling back this black armband view of history, but nothing happened, even the broadcaster. The ABC. He did nothing to reform it, let alone disband it or privatise it, while all these attacks through it continued on our nation. So it's been a very one-sided war.
Yeah, and just to give some credence with it, this kind of experience of what it was like to grow up in the 90s, I didn't have any awareness of my ancestry, culture, or connection with the country, or the idea that there was a nation. But there was. There was an Anglo-Celtic nation, and being of that former, you know, the nation used to control. Australia, I experienced, you know, we often call it LARPing, live-action role-playing, as LARPing as American, because I was looking for that some kind of identity. But it was very hard to find that in Australia. All you had was this narrative of white guilt. It was quite hard to live with that.
Oh, yeah, of course. I can imagine. Tough Love, let's switch over to you a little bit and see how things compare in terms of the, I guess, Aboriginals versus the Maori and that dynamic there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Maori people are definitely way more a normal part of New Zealand society than the Aboriginals are. But we have been for some time constantly bombarded through the media with, you know, we get told that New Zealand has the highest statistics of domestic violence. When you go and you actually break down the statistics, you realize what the percentages are, and they're heavily overrepresented in Maori. The prisons are 50%, the male prisons are 50% Maori, when they're only 15% of the population. Women's prisons are 60%. 50% of Maori are obese. So it's the same kind of picture. There's an overrepresentation in poverty, welfare as well. But the justifications given for these are displacement through colonization, this implied attempted genocide by the Europeans that came here on the Maori people to actually just sort of shuffle them off to the side and hope they die off. Systemic racism is a very commonly used excuse for the overrepresentation in crime. So whether it's the police who are picking on them, or whether it's the judges that are sentencing them, or whether it's a negligence and rehabilitation after prison time. But all of the stuff, again, like the Aussies were just saying, it's based on a skewed history that is very, very, very imbalanced against Europeans and towards the quote-unquote indigenous.
And let me add there, too. I mean, at least officially, right, they arrived 1200, 1300 sometime. And so the distance is not that far off from when, you know, what, 300 years later or so, you know, Europeans arrive. That doesn't like help in that picture at all. They just try to claim these are the natives and that's just how it is, right?
No, well, I mean, it's pretty much been, institutionalized now that they are the indigenous people.
Right.
Even though, yes, you're correct, it is widely accepted that they arrived somewhere around the 1200s and that they actually, I think the latest genetic research shows that they actually come from an indigenous Taiwanese tribe.
Hmm.
And then they move through Melanesia and Micronesia and Polynesia. And, you know, they even say that when they die, their souls go back to Hawaiki or whatever. So no, they're not indigenous, but it's actually like I was reading this review of our constitution that's going on at the moment, and it says Māori are the tangata whenua. They are the indigenous people, and that alone is a major fallacy that is causing all sorts of problems at the moment.
Yeah, so this is really an anti-white foundation that's laid here, because in that regard, I mean, there would be. Okay, let's compare that with the UK then, right, or Britain, where we had movements of other people, you know, the Anglos and the Saxons, and then later you had the Normans, you had Viking conquests before that, and they always tried to say, well, that's why Britain always has been multicultural, right? So,
yeah.
In the same way, you could reason the same about New Zealand, but do they do that on that same level?
Well, you know, it's. Something that really gets me is that there's a whole reparations industry today. So there's a whole system in place where historical claims against the crown dating back to 1840, when New Zealand essentially started, so wrongs done by the crown against Maori can be claimed upon by generations now, but
yeah.
You know, Europeans can't claim against of wrongs done against them by Maori, like families slaughtered, land taken.
Yeah.
And also there was so much intertribal warring before the treaty was signed and after. There aren't tribes claiming on tribes for wrongs done against each other. It's only one way.
Yeah, of course. Well, you know, again, it has to be recognized, and, you know, same thing goes for Australia, that the country as is didn't exist before. It was built by European hands, the infrastructure, the whole concept, the whole even idea of the law system, the structure that has actually allowed them to even make claims against them. That's a European invention, you know.
Well, that's a really big point. You know, there's this Ian Wishart in his book, The Great Divide, a really great book that fleshes out some important history that we don't usually hear about. And he has a great line in there where he says that there's this modern belief that before the evil colonists came to ruin everything, Maori were living like Smurfs amongst the trees.
Yeah, exactly.
It was peace, love, and tranquility.
The noble savage, right? That whole
the
idea.
The noble savage, yeah. and that's really annoying in a way because we also get held up against the wall for our concept of the noble savage.
Yeah, so
that,
exactly.
But that's a colonial idealization. But then we kind of get this false history fed to us that there was this structure that actually worked and there was ownership. But the reality was, and there's so much documentation about this, and it gets left out, like, you know, we've got the penguin, you can put that in echoes, by the way, the penguin history of New Zealand. And it's like the official text that's on everybody's coffee table, a big thick book of, you know, it breaks down the whole history of New Zealand. And cannibalism is mentioned like in one sentence in the whole book, whereas there's this whole wealth of information where basically what you had is you had this large landmass, well, small compared to Australia, but 120,000-odd Maori existing on this landmass in tribes, scattered sparsely. The South Island was practically empty, and it was constant warfare. So no one could hold on to any areas of land and actually make it productive or anything, because once you had something, it was taken off you by another tribe. Like, it was basically the law of the club. What's yours is yours because you take it. Might is right.
Right, yeah.
And so there was no ownership of anything. It seems that it was very dysfunctional. There was, you know, cannibalism was rife, slavery was rife. You know, the men would be killed, the women and the children would be enslaved. Female infanticide was rife because they wanted warriors. From what I can tell, it's really, you've got to take the official history that we're given today and sort of flip it on its head.
Right. Yep.
So it's, as you say, when the colonists, when the Treaty of Waitangi was signed in 1840, it was to bring law and order to a chaotic situation. And that call for law and order was asked for by a number of the chiefs of the tribes, because they had already had the missionaries come in and teach them Christianity, and they saw that this was their chance at salvation. There were chiefs who had gone back to England on some boats and visited and seen the productiveness and the order that was there, and they knew that this was actually their ticket to survive and actually have a quality of life. And so they wrote a letter to the king. And then, you know, the French were circling around. They really wanted, New Zealand for themselves. The British didn't actually really want it. In fact, it didn't really offer anything from the British, but because things were becoming so liberal in Britain at the time, they actually, I mean, you just don't get taught this at school. The well-being of the natives, of the Maori people, was of paramount importance, and there are a number of quotes to that effect that they didn't want to see the native populations go down the tubes like tended to happen in previous colonizations. So New Zealand was the first country where the well-being of the natives was most important.
You know, just briefly, was there a disease that killed a lot of off? Was there a lot of, war by Europeans, or, you know, conquest and taking over and battles that actually took out a lot of the Maori, or what happened there?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is another thing. Today we're given this picture that there was a massive dive in the Maori population, we're told, after 1840, after the signing of the treaty, because of the land wars, and we had such an impact on them. But a third of their population had already gone before 1840, and that was because of the musket wars. The Maori were fascinated by guns, and they saw the advantage of having a upper hand on their rival tribes, for obvious reasons. And one chief that went back to England, he got given these gifts by the king, and then he went via Australia, and he traded all the gifts for like 500 muskets or something, and then came back to New Zealand and just went on this rampage. And after the carnage was over, a third of the population of Maori had disappeared.
So this was internally among their own?
This was internally among their own.
Right.
And then they really struggled up until 1900 because of the female infanticide and the musket wars. There weren't that many kids being born. But today that's blamed on colonization, on the ravages of the land wars, which we can also talk about. So, I mean, it's just, you know, like, I mean, this makes me laugh sometimes. I grew up in an education system that didn't tell me any of the stuff.
Right. Of course not.
Or if it was some of it was mentioned, it was a footnote.
Yep. Heads they win, tails you lose. There's endlessly more we can say about the history, but let's talk a bit about, you know, how things kind of transpired into today and shift over to Australia a little bit and talk with the three other gentlemen here. Because I think we can all agree that it's a new colonization that's occurring right now in Australia, equally New Zealand. We have Islamic, Arabs, Middle Easterners, Asians, Indians, and many, many others. And one of the questions, of course, that we could hypothesize and discuss a bit is, would the same privileges be granted to the Anglo-Celts as a minority with special protection status and everything else that we have granted to other minorities internally? Gentlemen, talk with us about that a little bit in terms of how you see things developing internally in the country. What level is the immigration on, and how are things with demographics? Are Australians being, you know, rapidly replaced in the same way that we see in America and Europe?
Australia has one of the highest immigration rates amongst the developed world. And I think we receive around 250,000 people a year, which is...
I think technically it's actually the highest in the developed world.
Yeah, well, possibly the highest.
Interesting.
So, you know, it's equivalent of about 10% or more of our population each year. So it's a very, very high rate.
And each year? 10% each year?
Yes.
Wow. All right.
So it means that the largest group out of that is, in fact, Asian. There's still a substantial portion from the UK and Europe, but it's no longer more than 50%. And in terms of our local demographics, our replacement rate of native European Australians is below replacement, and the replacement rate of our new arrivals far exceeds replacement. So for Sri Lankan, Pakistani, and Indian women, it's more like 3 or 4 child per woman. For Chinese, it's closer to the European rate, but there are so many of them arriving that our demographic future is non-white, the same way as Europe and the United States, except that we're only receiving 12,000 Syrians, and so we don't have the same swamping as Europe does right now at this point in time, but we're receiving so many by plane that the boats and the lack of border control it's kind of not very comforting when we simply we allow them to come in planes instead.
Yeah, because I've heard, you know, an admiration for Australia's border the system of protection. There have been boats, I believe, that was have been sunk and stuff like that, but none of that matters, obviously, then, because they're brought in with legal means, as opposed to just walking into Europe as they're doing right now. If they could, they could probably send in, you know, way more. But I guess it's just a question of money and doing it fast enough.
Well, I mean, we do have a limit, which is a fully subscribed limit each year. So it's not that there could be a whole lot more if more people could get the money together, because there are very long waiting lists for legal and refugees. So we have quotas that are capped, but they're just such high quotas. And the question about the boats is interesting, because we have a kind of the history of Australian immigration is directly linked to boat refugees from Vietnam, where we took in boat people from after the Vietnam War, which was really the start of the non-white immigration to Australia. And so we had quite a tough policy on boats from the year 2000, when there was a boat called the Tampa, which was turned back, and there was lots of kind of kvetching from our media about that. But we had a tough boats policy, which was rescinded by a left-wing government, which then resulted in a huge spike of new arrivals by boat. So it went from just a few hundred a year to over 17,000. The following year, because all people realized that, hold on a second, we can get in by boat to Australia now because they relaxed the policy. And then our Conservative government reinstalled the old policy when they got into power, which has then stopped the boats. But like you said, as long as people come in planes, that's not going to protect the, and as long as our native population is not replacing itself sufficiently, then the numbers will eventually not be in our favor.
What's happening in as a reaction to this? Is there white flight in Australia?
There's been protest parties popping up, but most of the reaction has not to do with the Asian immigration. It has mainly to do with the Islamic immigration and
right.
the reproduction. It's quite like Canada in that we have a system where we actually import relatively highly skilled and from upper class backgrounds, say from India, upper class backgrounds, and Chinese people with money. And so we're getting people who are either buying a lot of property or are doing quite well in education, have low crime rates. And then we're also taking refugees from the Middle East and North Africa. And they do quite a lot of, commit quite a lot of violence. And that's getting a lot of attention. And that's kind of waking people up to what's happening in with this kind of immigration. But that's not the real disastrous consequence of immigration. The disastrous consequence is the, as Gustav was talking about, the Asian immigration who are doing most of the out-competing and displacement.
I think it was, Tori, you mentioned the Chinese buying up a tremendous amount of commercial and residential property. I think realty is sky high pretty much in Australia as it is in Canada.
Yes, they're willing to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars above reserve in order to get these properties. And our laws are set up such that, you know, they can hold on to these properties without even living here. We've got a lot of our own, national realtors actually targeting Asian buyers in their own homelands to purchase Australian property.
They call them China desks.
So our main realtors like LJ Hooker, not even talking about Asian ones, you know, advertising in, these Asian, what do you call it, the Asian desk, the China desk. So one recent example, this is just how absurd it is. There was a Tasmanian island up for sale called Ninth Island, which is inspired the name for a very popular wine brand here. Now, it was primarily targeted to Chinese buyers for over $1 million. So, that's what an absurd example here. But that's not it. I mean, that's a bit of an outlier. It's commercial property that is the big thing. And if you bring this fact up, even though everyone knows it, and every now and again you'll get a shock jock. So on talkback radio talking about this, or there'll be a story on a current affairs show, saying how bad it is that Australians are being priced out of our houses in Sydney and Melbourne. But it seems to dissipate this stink over it. But when someone actually offers a consistent critique of it, that's when everyone gets up in arms with the cries of racism. Where last year, one of these minor parties that Mammon was alluding to, it's called Party for Freedom. It's led by this fellow called Nick Folkes. And he was targeting one of the main areas where they're buying up in Sydney, in our a very wealthy area in the North Shore, Lane Cove and that kind of area. And so he was distributing flyers talking about being invaded by the Chinese. They were going through these auctions and protesting against, and it's quite actually, once again, the absurdity of it all. Like an all-Chinese audience at the auction, from the mainland, not even people born here at these auctions for these rather prestigious locations. So they were doing that. So they had the mayor offside. The mayor, gave some blustering speech about community cohesion and there's no problem. The problem is racism from these bigots. And then what really angered me was Anthony Roberts, who's meant to be part of the conservative faction of our so-called, our de facto conservative party, the Liberal Party. So he's a state member. So he's the local member there in our state parliament.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually referred the Party for Freedom onto the police for their, for their activism.
Yep.
That's just disgusting, absolutely disgusting. So yeah, this absolutely double standard, you know, every now and again, like, it just boils over. You can't hide what's happening with them, us being priced out of our places in Sydney and Melbourne in particular. But if you actually try to offer a proper critique of it, you get called racist.
Yeah.
I think the housing issue is actually the most serious thing facing young Australians, because there are actually many multiples of a yearly earning. And in Melbourne alone, and it's similar to Sydney, last year the housing price went up 10% in 1 year, and that's already on a decade of a boom. So inner city houses, small places, even very shabby, no renovation, going over $1 million.
Yeah. Amazing.
And that's just impossible for a young family to buy now.
Yeah.
And so this is, you know, leading to lower family formation, people having to choose different careers and different lifestyles. But still, as Victoria said, you can't talk about it. And there's a bipartisanship on both sides. On the left, you have these people importing these people for voters, giving out welfare. And you also have another big issue is the education sector, which is one of Australia's biggest technically exports. And there's hundreds of thousands of foreign students coming in who pay exorbitant fees to these institutions and then usually become citizens or permanent migrants afterwards, residents afterwards. And they claim we need these people because we have a skills gap and we need these people for growth. And a lot of it, again, is quite like Europe and Canada and America, where we need these people to basically secure our pensions. And so this is betrayal on all over the politics.
Yeah.
And we're kind of voice in the wilderness.
Yeah, the question is how long it can this abuse can go on, and if the economy can take it. How is the job situation, would you guys say, in Australia generally?
Unemployment is relatively low, but as usual, there's always some kind of understatement of the true level of unemployment, because, you know, you can be employed for 2 hours a week and be counted as employed. And, you know, the kind of employment is very unstable. Our traditional industries of manufacturing and agriculture have declined substantially. Now we don't really make anything ourselves. The mining boom is coming to an end. So that's kind of papered over our economic problems for the last 10 to 15 years. And so most of the prognosis, even in the mainstream, is that Australia is looking down a rather bleak economic future in the medium to long term.
I think it also matters where in the nation. So you have Melbourne and Sydney, which is basically receiving most of the migration and also internal migration from elsewhere of the country. But yeah, outside Melbourne and Sydney, there isn't a lot of growth. And in regional parts, say in regional Victoria, outside of Melbourne, there is actually no growth, and there's negative GDP. And if there wasn't basically apartment construction in Melbourne, Victoria as a whole would not be growing, the state Victoria. And so that's an indication, which is that we're trying to fuel this. Australia's had 20 plus years, basically all of our lifetimes had no recession, which is kind of unheard of. And we're basically terrified. The countries aren't terrified of that. And we're importing more and more people, more and more people to buy our properties. And we're also selling off state and big assets, big infrastructure assets to foreign buyers, because we're just fueling this growth because we're kind of terrified of letting it stop.
This just going into like selling off our assets, Australia, this is probably one of the biggest differences that sets Australia apart from the rest of the world. I cannot think of any other place in the world that calls selling off of large chunks of our country, calling it foreign investments. It's just a manifest fraudulent claim. It's not investment. We're not investing in new technologies here, building new buildings, or some of them are. But what they term foreign investment is selling off our electricity grid, rather like a 100-year lease to, I think it was South Australia, they did it to some Chinese firm. And the whole idea of making these leases is to get a short-term cash flow into the state government's coffers. And the pretext for doing it is to tell the populace that you're going to get cheaper energy. That wasn't the case. Prices increased. They recently did that in New South Wales. That's when, you know, every now and again when they do such a lease, you know, public anxiety about foreign takeover comes out. And, you know, it's kind of like the pressure valve, you know, the safety release that the media lets off a bit of steam before resuming to the usual, you know, anti-white bigotry that they have. But this time in New South Wales, it was, I think, some consortium of other actors came together to stop the Chinese from taking the lease. But probably one of the most damning ones would be the leasing of Darwin Port and the harbour there to the Chinese. That's just absolutely ridiculous. I mean, our security didn't even come up with some type of analysis as to how that could affect national security. I think the Americans had to tell us that that's a very bad idea. And then our own state security thought, oh, yeah, it could probably is, but we're going to go ahead with it anyway. But another big thing that's been in our headlines is Australia's largest and oldest dairy farm, it's located in Tasmania, has been bought up for, I think, about $300 million or so by a Chinese company. Now, what could that, free marketeer doctrinal types, you know, in our so-called conservative intellectual sphere, They're telling the electorate, oh, you're being such racist bigots. How dare you, cast aspersions on foreigners buying up this place? Because, in fact, it was previously owned by some foreign company, but it was still by some white people that it was owned by.
Owned by New Zealand, actually.
It was in New Zealand, yes. I was
New Zealand municipality.
Yeah. They just used that saying, oh, it was already foreign owned. What do you have to fear? The thing is,
that's a good one.
Typically,
yeah, completely. Well, I mean, New Zealand, Australia, we're all Anzacs. Is there any real difference? But,
we don't count New Zealanders as part of our migration program. they're not considered otters in that sense.
We love coming to your country. Yeah, we've had a fair bit of farm shenanigans going on here with Chinese buying up, and there's always a bit of an uproar by the racist majorities. We actually just had a meatworks that was bought by a Chinese company, and when it was handed over, the workers turned up to work like normal, and the doors were closed. And there was no, I'm not sure that it was, that there was no jobs for them. It's that there had been absolutely no provisions or plans for it to keep running. It had just basically, someone had bought it. It's kind of like if I bought a house and then didn't move into it for a while. Just all of a sudden these people had no income, like a whole meatworks. They were just, it had just stopped. So, we kind of get sandwiched between that. We've got, Chinese are 10% of our population. Heaps of students, buying up properties, you know, whole sort of suburbs, in cities become Chinese. Every time I go to Auckland, like the central city is just becoming like, you can't read the signs. It gets worse and worse and worse and worse. Then we've got Polynesians coming over because New Zealand is like a realm. So we've got, a small handful of Pacific Islands that, they can come in. So they're what, like 7%. So we're 30% non-white, which really is like, we're so entrenched in it now that people don't, a lot of people just don't see the wood for the trees. It's just seen as nature.
Yeah, you know, guys, there's so many parallels to what's happening in North America and Europe, even with the with realty and farms and, you know, these kinds of things as well is very interesting. It's almost like someone is planning it while rubbing their hands in glee. But let's talk a bit more about this after a short break. We're just kind of getting warmed up here, really, but we have much more to discuss. So, you know, we'll talk more about this aspect if it's just, you know, financial or you know, and who's promoting it and who's allowing it to happen. And also, of course, we need to discuss what the response to this should be, right, how we organize. How we plan to turn this around, and then we can discuss a bit more about, you know, there's many different factions here, and Islam is the more tangible, you know, radical in your face one, but there, you know, as we've spoken about already, the financial aspect and what the Chinese are doing is you know, equally worrying, if not even more, because they don't, you know, to a certain extent poke out, if you will, in the same sense that Islam is doing, and that's where probably where the major reaction initially will be. But let's do this before we just take a short break here. Let's just talk about some of the websites where people can listen to the show. I think you, Tough Love, you have also a website you wanted to give out, but let's begin with the podcast. And if you guys have any, you know, Twitter, you know, handles or Facebooks or anything like that you'd like to give out, if people, if you want people to reach out. So please go ahead, our Aussie gentlemen.
Sure thing. So our website is thedingoes.xyz, all one word, and our podcast is soundcloud.com/theconvictsreport. So you can find our podcast on our website. We also have a Twitter, which is @the_dingoes, and we have a Facebook account, which is facebook.com/thedingoes as well. So yeah, you can find us there.
All right, very good. Tough Love, do you have any website you want to give out?
Yeah, my blog is at toughloveletters.wordpress.com. That's where I post sort of original articles and some sort of creative writing.
Very good. Yeah, we'll take a short break. Interesting discussion. We'll pick up shortly. Stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back. that's our first hour. Thank you for listening. We are going to pick up and do another hour and a half together with Tough Love, Gustav Ossitori, and Mammon when we continue after a short break here. If you're a regular listener, you know that we have a member section where you can hear all our old archive shows and also the second hour of all the shows that we have available for free on our website. In our members archive, we have over 1,000 shows and 10 years worth of material. It's only €6 per month. Sign up for a 3-month subscription. It can be recurring or non-recurring. And try it out. If you like what we do, this will be a very important gift to yourself to open your eyes and help to wake you up or get you red-pilled, whatever you want to call it. We also have memberships that are 6 months, 9 months, 1 year, and all the way up to 2 years available. If you sign up for a 2-year subscription, for example, you get 4 months for free. So prices drop the longer membership you get. RedIceMembers.com is the website. Okay, well, we'll return and talk more about the plight and the fight in Australia and New Zealand when we return. You definitely don't want to miss it. Thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Don't miss hour 2. We'll be right back.